The history of African descendants in America is central to the U.S. story as a whole.
One of the arguments I make is not only do Black and white Americans share the same history, in terms of African Americans who are on the forefront of struggles for putting the ideals of democracy into practice, Black and white Americans also share a history in terms of having literally a shared ancestry.
That's Christina Proenza Coles. We talk with her about her groundbreaking new history, American Founders, How People of African Descent Established Freedom in the New World. Then we talk with Jamaican English author Sarah Collins about her breakout debut novel, The Confessions of Franny Langton. It's an historical thriller about a former slave who's accused of murdering her employer and his wife in Georgian London. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. And hey, do you know you can go to writersvoice.net to sign up for our free podcast and weekly newsletter? Find extra content there with links, book excerpts, and extended interviews. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. This week's episode of Writer's Voice is being produced on Juneteenth, the holiday that celebrates the freeing of enslaved African Americans throughout the former Confederate States of America. The history most Americans know is that Lincoln freed the slaves, and the mostly white abolitionist movement helped to bring that about. But what's missing from the story is the central role played by African Americans, both free and slave, in ending slavery in the U.S. But not just the U.S., also, before that, in England and throughout the colonial world. In fact, as my guest Christina Proenza Coles tells us, people of African descent were key protagonists in the story of American democracy. Her book, American Founders, chronicles how Black people developed and defended New World settlements, undermined slavery, and championed freedom throughout the Americas from the 16th through the 20th century. It's a terrific book with much to teach us about how African American history is a central part of the American story. Christina Proenza Coles, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you. I'm absolutely thrilled to be here.
In this book, American Founders, How People of African Descent Established Freedom in the New World, you write, "The implication of National Black History Month is that African American history is important, but it's separate and not quite equal to the larger American history. What are some of the myths and ideas about African American history that you want to dispel in this book?"
Well, the way I experienced history growing up as a kid in Miami, Florida in the 1970s and 80s was that slavery was a really dismal time in our history, but it was limited to the American South. And it was a long time ago, and it was nothing that we really needed to worry about. And the overall impression I got was that African Americans did not really step onto the stage of U.S. history until they arrived as plantation slaves in the 19th century, and that they don't really enter the political arena until the civil rights movement of the 1950s. But in further studying American history, not just U.S. history, but the history of the Americas at large, I came to recognize that people of African descent actually preceded Europeans and the New World by over a century, that African American history begins with European American history because people of African descent accompanied Columbus and all of the first New World forays into the Americas and participated in those settlements and the defense of those settlements, and also to recognize the other demographic fact that before 1820, four times as many Africans came to the New World as Europeans. So really the story of the Americas is an African-American story.
You say at one point in the book that, you know, we have a very binary view of history. It's Black or white, literally, or it's us versus them. But you really talk about a mixed, you know, that you say that this is a history of interaction. Explain that.
I got a very binary vision of history of white Americans did this, African Americans did that. And what I found in unpacking sort of the very beginnings of from the very beginning of the narrative up into the present day, things really are a lot more complicated. And even though it's easier to tell the story in the binary form, that certainly from the very beginning foundations of this country and all of the settlements of the New World, they were very interconnected, people from West and Central Africa and people from Northern Europe and Southern Europe. That it's a really combined story. And it's not as simple as slave and free and white and black, that people were, just for example, in the case of Virginia, the majority of the settlers of Virginia were indentured servants from Europe. And then they were almost immediately joined by a small but ever-increasing contingent of people intercepted from the slave trade who arrived in Virginia also as indentured servants. In the very beginning, in terms of Virginia not having laws specifically delineating all of the divisions between individuals. And so you have this kind of confusing time where you have white and black servants running away together, having children together. And you can see the Virginia legislature trying to scramble to catch up to how to adjudicate and to separate really these communities. But also there's examples of African slave owners, some of the very first planters in Virginia, Marion and Anthony, they came over on slave ships, but were able to work out their terms of service in earliest Virginia in the 1600s. And they eventually purchased property and they also purchased servants, both white and black. So the beginnings of our story are very, very much interconnected. I do think that going over, you know, across time, over the centuries, that story gets pulled apart increasingly through stringent laws about slavery and certainly laws about segregation sort of violently pull these communities apart. But looking at the day-to-day relations, there was a lot of interaction, interconnection, and certainly a lot of the people in the book have both white and black ancestry. So one of the arguments I make is not only do black and white Americans share the same history in terms of African Americans who are on the forefront of struggles for putting the ideals of democracy into practice, black and white Americans also share a history in terms of having literally a shared ancestry.
Including some of our most noted historical figures. What are some examples of that?
About a quarter of U.S. presidents owned slaves. And so those households certainly were interracial in terms of the people who lived in on those plantations and worked in those households. And sometimes it appears that these U.S. presidents also owned their own relatives. In the case of George Washington, it's thought that his wife, Martha Washington, may have owned her own half-sister. And also Martha Washington's son, grandson, I should say, apparently had a relationship with some enslaved women in Mount Vernon that resulted in children. And one of those children went on to become the de facto sister-in-law of Robert E. Lee. In other words, his quote-unquote legitimate children, one of his legitimate daughters went on to marry Robert E. Lee, but two of his illegitimate daughters were enslaved women from the Washington household. And also, of course, there's the famous examples of the Hemings family in Thomas Jefferson's household, which, you know, goes well beyond Sally Hemings to include, I think, something like 70 descendants who were part of that community, many of whom went on to do really extraordinary things in American history, who served in the American Civil War as Union soldiers, as both in both white and colored troops, as they called them then, individuals who went on to graduate top of their class in Harvard and establish newspapers and political movements, others who went on to serve in political positions in California and helped to establish University of California in the 1920s. So the descendants of these founders, if you will, continued to also establish and innovate and pioneer more democratic movements in subsequent centuries.
Yeah, and I love the way you use the term founders in this kind of enlarged sense in this book, American Founders, How People of African Descent Established Freedom in the New World. Christina Proenza Coles, you use the idea of founders throughout history, not just people who had a role to play, say, in the establishment, you know, which African Americans did, certainly in the establishment of our country.
Well, what I also say is that, you know, demographically, certainly people of African descent played an enormous role in settling and, as I said at the outset, defending New World colonies, certainly working in them. You know, the vast majority of this huge demographic shift is because of the Atlantic slave trade, which is an unprecedented demographic change in world history for 12 million individuals from one part of the world to be, you know, forcibly taken to another part. So economically, obviously, people of African descent shaped the New World. But also this specter of slavery was a founding part of every single settlement in the Americas. So it shaped our world, not only demographically and economically, but the politics and the culture. And there's virtually nothing that was untouched and was not shaped by the fact of debates around and the realities and contradictions of slavery. So everything was kind of shaped by this, from, you know, the traditional sense of the founding fathers, of the first presidents and their plantations and their residence and their time in the White House, to our infrastructure, to the way that universities were built, to the way that the sciences within those universities were produced and written. All of that was shaped and is touched in some way by slavery.
Yeah, and in fact, you point out that New World slavery was a very different kind of slavery than that practiced, you know, for millennia, that it in fact created the social fact of race.
Well, so because slavery begins with the very first civilizations on the planet, with ancient Sumer. I was surprised to learn that about 50% of the population of ancient Sumer, which is regarded as the first time humans come together in dense urban settlements, 50% of the population was enslaved. And so I was always stunned to think about, among the sort of first innovations, if you will, of human civilization that included, you know, record keeping and centralized government and economic specialization, among those innovations was, in fact, slavery, this mass, you know, these big having unfree labor. But what I will say is that none of these had anything to do with race, that originally slavery was justified by the rules of war. And so prisoners of war were considered legitimate slaves. Also, religion was a great sort of justifier and, in fact, sanctioned enslavement. And certainly heathens and infidels, regardless of you know, what the religion was, were considered legitimate slaves. The other important thing I'll say is that, you know, before, let's say, 1800, most people on the planet were unfree somehow. That the expectation of personal liberty and rights is a very new concept relative to the span of world history, that hierarchy was the framework for thinking about humanity for most of human history, that everyone had a place in the social order, that political and religious leaders were divinely on top of those social orders, and that there were unfree classes at the bottom of regardless of the civilization. So you didn't need race to kind of justify any sort of subservience or taking someone else's labor. It fit naturally with presuppositions of a natural hierarchy. And so the way I see it is you really start to get into trouble when that overt hierarchy is replaced in the United States with an ideology of democracy. Because how do you justify slavery in a Christian democratic nation? And my understanding is race, that creating a ideology of inherently different races becomes the way to rationalize and justify a system that otherwise can't be rationalized and justified with the precepts that all men are created equal.
Yeah, and you point out, you know, this is kind of connected to the Enlightenment, and we also think of the Enlightenment as a time that, you know, led to the age of, you know, scientific thinking. So these things that we think are so progressive, the Enlightenment, the introduction of science, have this darker side when there has to be some justification found for oppression.
Yes. I mean, I think some of it was, you know, in terms of the Enlightenment, you know, Europeans are turning from a period of time where the Bible was the authority of not just a religious scripture, but of the natural world. So to kind of come to terms with this much larger world than they had seen during the Dark Ages, that was pretty insular and based on a pretty limited source, to kind of understand and classify, you know, these different new worlds of cultures that they were unfamiliar with. They made some interesting and what we regard now not very scientific classifications. But when it becomes mapped onto the political and economic agendas that get tied up with a new world slavery, it could be put to some pretty nefarious uses. And I would say also add that, you know, these things aren't uniform and monolithic. And back to your point at the beginning, that we, you know, it isn't just black or white. And so I would say there were some philosophers, scientists, and religious thinkers who didn't think along these incredibly, you know, racialist and racist lines, who did urge the idea of a common humanity. But some of the science that we become more familiar with that takes more traction are these more racialist views.
Right. And of course, when I said science, I didn't mean that it was scientifically true, but more, quote, science, unquote, was used as a justification.
Absolutely. There's no question about it. I mean, I think history was used as a justification. science, social science, hard sciences, anthropology. There's no question that you can go through and sort, and people have, and deconstruct these studies and see, you know, for example, that in these studies of craniometry that try to suggest that races were superior and inferior, that, you know, for European examples, they were using the skulls of adult men, and for people of color, they were using the skulls of young women, which naturally, you know, tend to be smaller. So in other words, you can sort of trace this whole history of a flawed science. There's a counter tradition of people who weren't kind of jumping on this bandwagon, most of whom, as I'm putting in the book, are, you know, there's a long tradition of Americans of African descent who are fighting against this strain. And for example, there's a Haitian anthropologist named Antoine Fermin, who was writing in the 1860s explicitly against this pseudoscience, this racialist science of Gobineau and others. And he produced a book called, I believe it was called On the Equality of the Human Races, where he used science to disprove and illuminate the flaws in that racial science. So I guess I was trying to make the point that there has always been this kind of countercurrent out there. But as you said, the pseudoscience was often used to sort of justify the status quo.
Yeah, and also like this, you also point to the central role of people of African descent in the Americas in creating the language of human rights, of democracy, in many ways, I mean, not solely creating it, but really adding to our lexicon and our understanding and our laws around egalitarianism, around democracy. For example, give us the example of Isabel de Oliveira. Tell us who she was and her impact on rights and law.
So Isabel de Oliveira, she was living in Mexico, what was called New Spain at the time, which, you know, the Spanish were settling the Americas before the English began their settlement in Jamestown in North America. And she was preparing to make an expeditionary trip to what is today New Mexico in North America. And before setting out, she wrote an affidavit attesting to her free status. And in it, she uses some language. This is 1600. And in it, she's using very modern language, attesting to her free status, demanding justice, demanding legal recognition of her rights. And this is before many of the sort of classical tracts in the Enlightenment about individual rights. And back to the point about how slavery is different in the New World, it's because this discourse of rights is kind of beginning, and also because people of African descent are being denied these rights. I mean, why does Oliveira feel compelled to carry an affidavit in the first place? She says, because I'm mulatto and I may be annoyed. In other words, there already is developing an expectation with people of African descent that they are potentially slaves. And so it's because Americans of African descent are denied rights that they are on the forefront of legal, military, political, cultural, and scholarly conflicts to try to establish and protect rights. So again, back to what's different between old slavery and New World slavery is that, you know, in the ancient period, as we said, slavery had nothing to do with race. And so once someone could obtain their freedom, they could go on to participate in the society. They could, you know, essentially marry, you know, there's nothing legally denied to them. And what's unusual is that in the United States, certainly the degree of rights that are denied to people who are enslaved, progressively too, this is not in 1600, but as we go on, as we get closer to the end of slavery, you can see the laws around slavery tightening and tightening against literacy, against marriage, against assembly. And so that kind of full-scale, complete denial of rights to enslaved individuals, it's a pretty unique thing in the history of slavery around the world. And the other thing that's unique is to deny rights to people who are formerly enslaved based on their ancestry. So the fact that free people of color are also denied rights, denied access to institutions. So this is the thing that puts people of color on the forefront of these battles to establish democracy. And it is at a time where there's going to be a flourishing language and discourse and rhetoric of democracy that people of African descent readily capitalize on, whether it's during the American Revolution, during the Haitian Revolution, the Latin American Wars of Independence. They are very adept at using this language to advance the idea that nationalism and citizenship requires the end of slavery and the end of discrimination.
And then there's the example of James Somerset, who, you know, was instrumental in ending slavery in England. That was in 1772. Talk about him and what he did and what impact that had on the move for independence in the U.S.
James Somerset was purchased in the United States in Virginia, in Norfolk, as an enslaved person by a British customs agent. And they eventually moved to England, where James Somerset takes leave of his master. He runs away. And his master recovers him through slave catchers and has him bound on a ship set to go to the Caribbean. Well, he will be put back into slavery. And James Somerset sues for his freedom in court. And as you said, 1772, 1773. And this had happened a few times in England and in France, where enslaved people who were accompanying masters from the Caribbean, from the Americas, would sue for their freedom in court. And my understanding is that in the previous cases, that the judge was able to lean on the owner either to individually manumit that person, or I know of a case in England, for example, where the owner was in absentia, the owner was in the Caribbean, and the judge said, okay, you can be a free person until the master returns. In other words, there are these kind of piecemeal jury-rigged solutions. But in this case, the owner would not manumit Mr. Somerset. So the judge Mansfield was forced to rule on the legality of slavery in England. And after much deliberation, he decided that there was no positive law to support the institution of slavery in England, and therefore Mr. Somerset was free, and therefore slavery in England was technically illegal. So this is a very important decision, and some scholars have called this the beginning of a firm idea of freedom in English law. So it has a big impact in England, but also it has a really big impact on people in the United States, or the future United States, because they are still British subjects in 1773. So this news is considered very bad news by Southern planters. And so some scholars have argued it may have been a tremendous motivation, besides the traditional arguments of don't have taxation without representation, that a major motivating factor for planters whose livelihoods relied on slavery were made nervous by a ruling in England that said slavery was, you know, essentially morally reprehensible and illegal. At the same time, it was a very inspiring decision for enslaved Americans. And there are a few examples of runaway slave notices that actually cite the case, saying that these individuals fled, and I believe they're trying to get on a ship to England because they're aware of the Somerset case. And there's also an example, there's three petitions that were submitted in Massachusetts around the same time from enslaved individuals, because of course there was slavery in the North as well, until after the American Revolution, who were petitioning for their freedom, citing the case as well as other cases actually in Latin America, which is interesting, the sort of Atlantic sensibility that people of African descent had in this sort of never-ending endeavors to eradicate slavery. And even though, you know, we kind of know the end of the story, we're about to come up on Juneteenth and Emancipation Day, celebrating the day of that, you know, enslaved people in the United States learned of Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation. But as I say in American Founders, emancipation was not a gift that Lincoln bestowed on Americans of African descent. This is something, this move to eradicate slavery and to put rights into practice is something that you see from the absolute beginning of the New World and the very first settlements of enslaved people and people of color starting in the 1500s.
This is Writer's Voice, and I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking with Christina Pruenza Coles about her book, American Founders, How People of African Descent Established Freedom in the New World. So you could almost say that it's not so much that Lincoln freed the slaves, talking about the Emancipation Proclamation, but that slaves were the ones who freed the slaves. Talk about the slave rebellions in the U.S. and just the whole panoply of actions, both North and South, of people both free and enslaved, that really brought about their own emancipation.
Well, I guess that, you know, the very first slave revolt was on a plantation of Christopher Columbus's son. So that lets you know that, you know, as soon as plantation slavery was instituted, people were rebelling against it instantaneously. And the list of slave revolts in the earliest Spanish settlements throughout, you know, the Caribbean and Latin America is legion. And there were, from the beginnings of these settlements, what they called maroon communities, which is where fugitive slaves would liberate themselves and form independent, autonomous communities that these colonial governments could not subdue. And in several cases, it resulted in what you call maroon wars, where the colonial state is fighting against these maroon communities, often in guerrilla warfare, and unable to subdue them. And so you get cases throughout the New World for example, in Jamaica, Mexico, Panama, Venezuela, Suriname, where the colonial government is going to have to negotiate with these communities, may offer them some tribute, offer them some autonomy, and offer them some rights, if you will, to sort of quell these conflicts.
But what about here in the U.S., you know, just in the sense of the run-up to the Emancipation Proclamation? In your book, American Founders, I don't think most of us understand the critical role that was played by people of African descent in getting to that Emancipation Proclamation here.
It is a very long and continuous journey. So, for example, I was describing resistance in Latin America, but the story also is continuous in English America as well, that you can see from the very first statutes of the Virginia colony in the 1660s, you know, enslaved people running away and resisting was an enormous problem. You can see in Bacon's Rebellion in 1676, an interracial movement for freedom with white indentured servants and enslaved Africans who are resisting the colonial state. You can see in the Stono Revolt, which is a slave revolt in 1739, that South Carolina, the official record of the revolt says that these enslaved Americans were fighting for, and I'm quoting South Carolina official report, they were fighting for liberty and life. They were literally chanting liberty as they were leaving slave plantations in South Carolina in 1739. And so you can see this again in the American Revolution as enslaved people chose to reject slavery by fighting on both sides of that war. And certainly you can definitely see it in the run-up to the American Civil War. There's a lot of political movements happening in the 1830s, what's called the Colored Conventions, where free people of color are gathering throughout northern cities, especially to discuss the best way to end slavery and establish full citizenship rights. You can certainly see it in, you know, I think people are familiar with the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850. The reason why that act is created is because fugitive slaves are causing an enormous political problem. People are, you know, at very great risk fleeing plantations in the South, getting to the North. Sometimes they're going all the way through the Underground Railroad to Canada. Sometimes they're going to, you know, a new life in northern cities in the United States. Sometimes they're being subdued by slave catchers and going to court. And there's a section in American Founders where I talk about these sort of great slave rescues of the 1830s and 40s, where you'd see African-American lawyers and court spectators, and as well as white Americans, coming in to help to protect fugitives, purported fugitive slaves, before they're returned to plantation slavery in the South, or people would actually intervene in the courtroom and physically take the individuals and help, you know, shelter them to get to freedom along the Underground Railroad. So there are tremendous movements. If you read South Carolina's Declaration of Secession, that is, ignites, you know, the Civil War, they're essentially complaining that the North is not taking these fugitive slave problems very seriously, and they're reneging on their promise that they made at the founding of the nation that was enshrined in the Constitution in the original fugitive slave law, that they're failing to appropriately return, you know, the property of slave owners. So you can see that this was the major sticking point that was pushed along by people of African descent. So people of African descent, I would argue, helped to ignite the political tensions that set the Civil War in motion. And once they do, they fight in that war as 200,000, you know, enlisted soldiers. And I will say, you know, admit that if you read the Emancipation Proclamation, Lincoln says in the proclamation that it is a fit and necessary war measure of war to enlist African-American men to help serve in the Union armies, which they had been doing. They had, since the beginning of the first shots at Fort Sumter, African-American families had been fleeing plantations and joining federal armies and trying to volunteer their service. And the Emancipation Proclamation is the legalizing mechanism to make it those enlistments official and legal. So I would argue that African-Americans were instrumental in instigating and fighting and winning the war that brings U.S. slavery to an end and ideally democracy to a beginning.
One of the interesting things to me in the book was not only the agency of African Americans in freeing themselves and in promoting the ideas that led to their increased participation in the civil world, but also how these ideals impact all Americans. You know, we live in a time where multiculturalism is, you know, there are culture wars over multiculturalism, where divide and conquer seems to be the order of the day of some of our major political leaders. Talk about the impact of these struggles on Americans' ideals and ideas of ourselves and how we can go forward taking the lessons of those struggles.
Well, like you said, you know, when I say in the book, multiculturalism is not politically correct. It's historically accurate. It is truly our history that it has been shaped by European Americans, African Americans, and Native people from Asia. It's a very complex history. But what I wanted to say in American Founders was a lot of these Americans of African descent, you know, for example, Charles Ramond of Massachusetts, he was an abolitionist in 1830s Boston, who was advocating not just for the end of slavery, he was also advocating for women's vote, the woman's right to vote. So many of these American founders, as I call them, could see that universal rights for all American citizens were critical, that it wasn't just about the Black liberation struggles. These were paving a way for a larger democracy with freedom and rights that we all enjoy today. So one of the messages I wanted to get across in American Founders was that we Americans, and I wanted to also encourage readers to think about what we mean when we say we Americans, to include in that notion maybe a more richer, complicated understanding of the role that enslaved Americans and free people of color have played in that history, to recognize that we have a shared history and that we have these democratic traditions which we can celebrate and on which we can build going forward in the future.
Well, Christina Proenza Coles, the book is American Founders, How People of African Descent Established Freedom in the New World. It's just a fascinating read. Thank you so much for talking with us on Writer's Voice.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
Christina Proenza Coles. You can find wonderful photos of some of the American founders in her book by going to writersvoice.net. Next up, a gothic novel about a remarkable woman, a former slave accused of murder in Georgian England. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. And I invite you to sign up for the free Writer's Voice podcast and newsletter at writersvoice.net. You can find more great content there, including web-only features like book recommendations and extended interviews. My next guest, Jamaican-born English writer Sarah Collins, always loved Gothic novels. And she didn't like the slave narratives of the anti-slavery movement of the 19th century. So when she set out to write a Gothic novel herself, she decided she would write a very different kind of story about slavery, one that voiced all the brilliance, humanity, rage, and passion of its protagonist, accused murderer Franny Langton. Franny is a servant and a former slave. She's also a voracious reader and commentator on the English literary canon. She's also the lover of her murdered mistress. The Confessions of Franny Langton is Sarah Collins' debut novel. Her story, as told in The Confessions of Franny Langton, makes up Sarah Collins' debut novel. The Washington Post called it, quote, a startling, compelling historical debut novel that should be on the top of your vacation reading pile. Sarah Collins, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you very much for having me.
This is just a terrific debut novel, a Gothic novel you talk about. First of all, tell us, what is a Gothic novel and what attracted you to this genre before we start talking about the body of the book?
I have always had a deep and abiding love for Gothic novels. It started when I was a teenager. They were really the first grown-up novels I remember reading and loving, in particular Wuthering Heights and Jane Eyre. And I absolutely enjoy the immersive, heart-in-your-throat feeling of reading a good Gothic, the suspense, but also the idea of coming up close to all of the kind of dark and twisted things that we can get up to, and being able to enjoy being told these terrible, terrifying stories. So it's kind of the, you know, the child with the monster under the bed feeling.
Yes, and this is a terrifying story that takes place within a terrifying institution of slavery. So there is really the power of that historical narrative as well.
Yes. It actually occurred to me when I was writing the book, I was drawn first and foremost to write a Gothic novel, not a novel about slavery. But it occurred to me when I was writing the book that, on a more serious note, that the Gothic is the ideal vehicle for exploring those more horrible aspects of human nature and the more terrible things we've done to each other. And that in particular in the context of plantation slavery, you have the setting, you have the people being put through very extreme circumstances. You have the evocative and immersive nature of the language. It all seemed to line up for me. And so I ended up being drawn to that particular story told in that particular kind of way.
And yet you have written that you were reluctant to write a novel about a woman who had been a slave. Why is that?
That's absolutely true. I had this sense that every time I encountered a black character in historical fiction, they were going to be a slave, and they were almost inevitably also going to be a victim. And I began to feel quite fed up about that. After a while, it does start to feel a little bit cliched, a little bit one note. And I was really concerned about the fact that as a black reader, sometimes when I'm told that a novel is a story about a slave, that there's this little part of me that thinks, oh, well, you know, perhaps I know what that's going to be about. And so I did resist it. I kind of dragged my own self kicking and screaming to write this novel. And it's because there was a story there. It's because ultimately I felt that I might be able to say something different. And that was that my protagonist, Franny Langton, is a different kind of character in this context. So for a start, she's educated. She's incredibly passionate. She's really angry, and she expresses it. But also, and most importantly to me, she's in love. She falls in love with her mistress, and they have this very twisted, obsessive love affair, which I felt, for me, I wanted to kind of invoke echoes of Wuthering Heights and Jane Eyre in that, in her really strong attraction to this other woman. And I felt that it was worth doing because there was something there that I hadn't seen before and that I would have wanted to see.
Something there you hadn't seen before, just in the sense of a character that is, so breaks the boundaries of the stereotype, is that it?
Yes, a character who had been a slave, but then managed to come away from that and have all of these other experiences to bring to the table all of these other qualities, in particular the fact that she's such a voracious reader, that she almost sort of surveys the whole of early English literature and assesses the impact that her exposure to it has on her, and the fact that she has this love affair which really changes her dramatically. And I hadn't seen a love story, a Gothic romance, featuring a black protagonist in that way.
So now you've given us the psychological flavor of the book. Orient us to the time. You begin the book back in Jamaica on a plantation. Tell us about the character, Franny Langton, and where she grows up.
Franny is a young Jamaican woman. When we encounter her, she is just being brought into the Old Bailey in London, and she's on trial for the double murder of her London employers, George Benham and his wife, Madame Benham. She, in order to convince the reader and her own lawyer, and we begin to suspect herself that she's not guilty of these terrible crimes that she's accused of, she starts writing her life story, beginning on the Paradise Plantation in Montego Bay, where she grows up. And she is there under the thumb of quite a sadistic plantation owner called John Langton, who involves her in some sinister experiments that are taking place on his plantation, and which Franny at first goes along with because she's so keen to get herself an education and to have access to the great house and the books that she kind of slips into his clutches in a way. The plantation is destroyed by fire, which leads Langton to bring Franny to London and give her as a gift to George Benham, who's not a scientist, a famous natural philosopher. And while there, she is instantly smitten with his wife, enigmatic Frenchwoman named Marguerite. And the two fall in love. But months later, when Benham and Marguerite are murdered, suspicion falls on Franny. And so the book essentially is her way of attempting to defend herself by explaining herself, but also to come to terms with some of the guilt and the shame that she might be carrying about exactly what happened at Paradise.
Those experiments, I was surprised to find out that they are actually, those kinds of experiments are part of historical record. What did you find out about medical experiments that were done kind of Mengele fashion back in slavery time?
Yeah, I was surprised as well. It was the most heartbreaking and the most surprising aspect of my research for the novel. Not just that it happened, but that there's actually quite a lot of information out there about it. And we don't pay enough attention to it, I think. And so I stumbled upon it when I picked up a book by Andrew Curran called The Anatomy of Blackness, which talks about how the ideology justifying slavery was built on skin color experiments and a range of pseudoscientific experiments in relation to what causes variations in color. And also at the same time stumbled upon Crania Americana, which was Samuel Morton's catalog of differences in skulls between men of various nations, and essentially this sort of precursor to this phrenological idea of a link between skull size, which really means race, and intelligence. And then there's a lot of other work that's been done about the role that plantation doctors played in the West Indies. So I had a rule that the experiments which are described in the book would not come from imagination, but from research. And so they're all documented in articles or books that I came across about these plantation doctors, who essentially had captive subjects, which is what they thought of the people under their control as, who were unable to object and, you know, as a result were almost tempted to abuse their power and stretch the bounds of ethics. And I was fascinated by this because it was a way in which people who had been enslaved had suffered that I had not come across before. It wasn't the stereotypical idea of how people suffered on plantations. But it also tied into the project I thought I had started with its gothic flavors and, you know, the idea of these mad scientists who are manipulating Franny and everyone around them and whether they will ever be visited by the consequences of their terrible behavior.
Yeah, and I said before that I was surprised, but I just remembered actually that there was an American doctor who experimented on, I think it was...
On women. Are you thinking of J. Marion Sims?
With the fistula, the repair
of
the fistulas.
Yes, I think that he's known as the father of modern gynecology. And exactly, he's a very good example of someone who really abused his power and his oath as a doctor. So he conducted experiments in repairing, in surgery essentially, on postpartum women without anesthesia, and they were all enslaved women somewhere in America. I can't remember which American state it was. But that's a good example, and there were examples like that throughout the Caribbean as well.
This is Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Sarah Collins about her acclaimed novel, The Confessions of Franny Langton. And so go back to the idea of the slave narrative, which is something you actually critique pretty openly in the book. There's a scene in the book where a former servant in Benham's household, the footman, who has now, you know, become a speaker for the abolition movement, very interesting talk, a rage-filled, bitter talk. I mean, it reminded me in some ways of Frederick Douglass talking about the July 4th.
Yeah.
It was even more intense, however, in which he calls out the slave narrative. So I wonder if you could talk about that. And I mean, you've already mentioned how now you've made a character who is a full person. But this, from the point of view of how slave narratives were constructed and who their audience was for, and then how you constructed this book and the voice that you were giving to your character, Franny Langton.
I think the difference is exactly what you've put your finger on, which is who is your audience. And the thing about slave narratives that's always troubled me is they begin to sound very much the same because they're all designed to do one thing, which is to explain to a largely white audience what was happening and why it was important that it should stop. But as I've said elsewhere, that tells you about what happened to people and not about who people were. And I think the difference with Franny's story and with Laddie, who's the character you mentioned, who is the abolitionist speaker, the ex-footman in the Benham household, is that in a way they take the gloves off. So they're saying what I imagine people would have been thinking and perhaps been too polite to say. I wanted them to be irreverent. I wanted them to be slightly humorous, but also to be poking fun at the hypocrisy of people who were sort of sweetening their tea with sugar, but then going to these abolitionist speeches. It's actually sort of calling out the elephant in the room, which was the thing that couldn't be done with those slave narratives because they were constrained by the agendas of the editors and the abolitionist societies themselves. I wanted Franny and Laddie really to give free rein to what I think would have been the honest responses to what had happened to them, which included anger. It did include rage. And that's not seen enough in either the nonfiction or fictional response to slavery, the fact that people must have been downright angry, not always saddened and appalled, but actually enraged as well at what had happened to them.
Yes, I think about how forbidden that kind of language is even now. You know, when Obama was president and you had the case of, now I've forgotten his name, but the Harvard professor who came home and was accosted by the police as he mounted his own porch steps. And, you know, Obama said something that just referred to that this is a common thing among the black community. And Obama was no drama Obama. Of course, he never spoke in a rageful way. But the kind of, you know, how he was excoriated. He had transgressed to dare point out that there was anything about injustice in racism in America.
It's interesting to me if you ask yourself the question, who is really allowed to express anger in public? It almost lines up, in my opinion, with who has been allowed to write historically, who has been allowed to love historically. It all really comes back to the age-old question of power. And for me, those were the live wires of the novel, those three strands, the love story, the expression of anger, the engaging in the world of reading and writing as a way of restoring humanity. It seems really important to me because the groups who have been excluded from doing all of those things are the groups who have been marginalized and disenfranchised throughout history.
Yes, and that brings me to the other, you know, the way you talk about not just race and the, you know, constructions of power around that, but also around gender. And at some point, Franny Langton says, what's really impossible is that she's both black and a woman.
Yes, as if it's impossible to be both at the same time, which is how she feels. She also says, a man writes to separate himself from the common history, but a woman writes to try to join it. And it was important, I think, for her story that she keeps on reminding the reader that she is a woman. I was almost going to say also a woman, but that feeds into this idea that you can't be black and a woman. And so it was her agenda, really, to assert not only her humanity, but her femininity as well. And I think that's why it was natural for her to fall in love with her mistress. I'm asked often why two women, why didn't Franny fall in love with a man when she came to London? But it just seemed to me the most natural reaction to her life, to her circumstances, to who she was, and to what was going on around them, that she and her mistress, who in a way sort of subverts the mad woman in the attic trope, you know, she lives high in this mansion house in Mayfair and she's an opium eater, she's addicted to laudanum and very eccentric, but that they find safe space together in this room high in the house where they conduct their love affair. And in many ways, they have more in common, a white French woman and a mixed race former slave from Jamaica, than anyone else in the novel. And that connection between two women was one of the most powerful things for me in writing it. And it seemed to supersede all of the other barriers and categories that people were trying to impose on each other in those days, and I suppose that, you know, that they persist to this day.
And yet there is a difference, a power differential in their relationship.
Yes, it's an honest relationship, and so it is a flawed one. And, you know, one of the questions is whether the way Franny sees the relationship is actually the way it was, which I suppose is a question we can ask about anything we are writing down, or anything that we're remembering, whether we're just telling ourselves a story, and how can we get to the absolute truth of something. And so one of the questions which Franny has to come to terms with is, was this real love and was it good for her? Because it's quite a turbulent and tormented love affair in many ways.
Right, and it ends up quite tragically. Now, I had a question about that. I mean, she's a victim not just because she's a slave and a woman, but precisely because she's a person who has a very strong sense of her own self-worth. And that sense of self-worth engenders the rage of others towards her.
Yes. I think at one point one of the characters describes her as uppish, which will be familiar to many people who, you know, not just anger is perceived as challenging, but self-worth sometimes. And the more Franny comes into her own, the more confident she becomes about herself, the more of a challenge and a threat she may be to the centers of power around her, certainly. But then, you know, the more agency she develops. And the question with her, I think, is whether how her anger could be purposefully directed and how her self-worth could be purposefully directed, and whether she gets that right in the end.
Could you say more about that?
I suppose what I was grappling with is this idea of what can you really do when your hands are tied. So is the more valuable change something that happens internally, or is it about the actions that you can take either against others or in relation to yourself? And so there's a question about what Franny does ultimately and what she takes responsibility for, and whether she's managed to heal herself in a way by the conclusion of the novel.
This is Writer's Voice. We're talking with Sarah Collins about her acclaimed novel, The Confessions of Franny Langton. You know, I wondered, why is this centered around a murder? Did that come to you first as the kind of central plot construction of the book? Or, you know, is it inevitable that it must be a murder?
What came to me first was this really powerful image of a woman, a maid, a black maid, on the steps of a London mansion. And I knew it was early 19th century, you know, sort of shivering and frightened and disoriented and having just been accused of killing her mistress and her protesting. And in fact, the protest was the first sort of complete line that came to me as well. But I never would have done what they say I've done to Madame because I loved her. And so I thought, well, you have a predicament here. You have a mystery. And I do love a good story. I really wanted to write a page turner, something that would have threads that people need to piece together and that sort of keeps them reading. You have a mystery, but you also have a sense of shimmering rage, that there's something, there's this strong protest. So there's this woman who is being held, but already she's raging against it. Already she is pushing against what she's being told. And that kind of encapsulated the character for me. I thought I could do something with that, you know, that I could carry through the form of a court trial. I could carry through this idea of exploring where her real guilt lay by looking at this guilt on the surface, the question of guilt or otherwise on the surface about the crime of which she's accused. She could also do some internal examination about things that she might really have to atone for.
Right, because a whole system of slavery contaminates all relationships.
So. Exactly. And there's also a sense in which, you know, what's happening in a trial is only the tip of the iceberg. And there's also a sense in which the people who should really be on trial, the people who should really be indicted throughout the novel, will never face justice because, of course, they're the people who control the courts and the justice system.
Yeah, exactly. You know, there are points of familiarity. Recently, there have been a number of books talking about women's rage. And so I wonder if you could talk about yourself, maybe how you have negotiated rage that you have felt, the oppression of yourself or of Black women, as I've had to struggle all my life with negotiating the rage I feel with how I'm treated as a woman.
Yes, that is such an excellent question. I wonder if it's something that's still in motion for me, that we spend our lives trying to come to terms with how we deal with rage. But I think one of the big things I've learned with experience is not to feel ashamed of it. I think we are conditioned to think that rage is something negative, and that it's something that doesn't speak well of us, and that it's loose and uncontrolled and hysterical, which are not qualities that we should aspire to have. I've learned to think about it as more purposeful, and to think about it as something that I can use. So, for example, rage fueled this novel. I like to say it's anger that wrote my first novel, because I wrote it during 2015 and 2016, and I had a real sense of helplessness, which I think is one of the wellsprings of anger, about, you know, political events across the Atlantic, both in America and in England, which is where I live. And where was I to channel that? I feel that writing is one of the most effective places for us to explore anger, in fact, and that's what I did. I channeled it into a 19th century character who would also have been denied the opportunity to express rage, and I felt it was quite cathartic. But I think it starts with letting go of the shame which has been imposed on us, and then deciding what we want to do with it. And it's so gratifying that women are now doing that and are writing about it. I've just read Rebecca Traister, I don't know if I'm pronouncing her name correctly, but Good and Mad. And, you know, women are doing this now, both in fiction and nonfiction. And it's about time, if you ask me.
Hear, hear. And you do it. I mean, it's just a terrific story, brilliantly written book, The Confessions of Franny Langton. Now, this is being made into a TV series in Britain, is that correct?
That's correct. It's been optioned by Drama Republic, and I am writing this screenplay for them, so I've had to take off my novelist cap and try to figure out what a screenwriter's cap looks like and put one on. So I'm really excited and diving into that project now.
I really hope it comes to this side of the pond.
Oh, I hope so, too. It will if I have anything to do with it. I'll work as hard as I can.
That's great. Well, it's just been terrific talking with you, Sarah Collins, about your debut novel. Let's call it a breakout debut novel. It's getting huge accolades. The Confession of Franny Langton. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a huge pleasure.
Sarah Collins. Go to writersvoice.net to read an excerpt from The Confessions of Franny Langton. Next week, best-selling crime novelist Anthony Horowitz returns to Writer's Voice to tell us about the next in his meta-mystery series that features himself as a Dr. Watson to modern-day Sherlock Holmes, Daniel Hawthorne. Don't miss it. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Do you know you can go to writersvoice.net to sign up for our podcast and weekly newsletter? Find extra content there with links, book excerpts, and extended interviews. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.